Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story on the main page. It's entitled, or headlined, Truce Continues in Gaza Strip. Hamas, Israel release more captives. Blinken encourages extension. And there's three authors, Wafa Sharafa, Jack Jeffrey, and Melanie Lidman of Associated Press wrote this. And it says, Gaza Strip, Hamas freed 8 Israeli hostages Thursday in exchange for the release of more Palestinian prisoners under a last-minute deal to extend their ceasefire in Gaza by another day. Any further renewal of the truce, now in its 7th day, could prove more daunting since Hamas is expected to set a higher price for many of the remaining hostages. Hamas freed 6 of the hostages hours after releasing 2 Israeli women Thursday afternoon. All were handed over to the Red Cross in Gaza and were being brought to Israel to be taken to hospitals and be reunited with their families, the Israeli military said. At least 10 Israelis a day, along with other nationals, have been released during the truce, in return for Israel's release of at least 30 Palestinian prisoners. Asked why Hamas on Thursday released fewer than 10 hostages, as outlined in the ceasefire agreement, the military's chief spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, noted that 12 Israeli citizens were released the day before, implying that the overall total met Israeli demands. Israel was to free 30 Palestinian prisoners later in the evening under the deal. International pressure mounted for the truce to continue as long as possible after weeks of Israeli bombardment in a ground campaign following Hamas's deadly October 7 attack on Israel that triggered the war. The Israeli retaliation killed thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, and more than 3/4 of the population of 2.3 million are uprooted, leading to a humanitarian crisis. Israel vows to resume the fighting once the ceasefire ends, and the ceasefire is set to expire early Friday, though international mediators are working to extend it. The talks appear to be growing tougher, with Hamas having already freed most of the women and children it kidnapped on October 7. The militants are expected to make greater demands in return for freeing scores of civilian men and soldiers. About 140 hostages are believed to remain in Hamas captivity. And as of this reading, the ceasefire may have already been stopped. I read on. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top officials on his third visit to the region since the start of the war, said he hoped the ceasefire could be extended and more hostages could be released. Blinken also said that if Israel resumes the war and moves against southern Gaza to pursue Hamas, it must do so in compliance with international humanitarian law and must have a clear plan in place to protect civilians. He said, Israeli leaders understood that the massive levels of civilian life and the displacement scale we saw in the north not to be repeated in the south. Most of Gaza's population is now crammed into the south with no exit, however, raising questions over how an Israeli ground assault backed by bombardment can avoid heavy civilian casualties. Qatar and Egypt, which played a key role in the mediating, seek to prolong the deal by another 2 days, said Dia Rashan, the head of Egypt's State Information Service. Thursday morning, Palestinian gunmen opened fire on people waiting for buses along a main highway entering Jerusalem, killing at least 3 people and wounding several others, according to Israeli police. The 2 assailants, brothers from a neighborhood in annexed East Jerusalem, were killed. And the attack, Israel detained 6 other members of the family, and the government ordered their house be demolished. Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack, casting it as retaliation for the killing of women and children in Gaza and the occupied West Bank and other Israeli crimes. The attack did not appear to threaten the truce in Gaza, but escalating violence, including Israeli raids in the West Bank and East Germany, could blow back to wreck the quiet in Gaza, even though these areas are not covered under the ceasefire. On Wednesday, Israel troops killed two Palestinian boys during a raid in Jenin, according to Palestinian health officials. The Israeli military separately said the raid killed two Islamic Jihad militants. Netanyahu is under intense pressure from families of the hostages to bring them home, but his far-right government partners are also pushing him to continue the war until Hamas is destroyed and could abandon his coalition if he is seen as making too many concessions. The initial truce, which began Friday, has been extended twice, called for the release of women and children. Israel officials said before Thursday's hostage releases that Gaza militants still hold about 30 women and children who would all be released within a few days at the current rate. The two women released earlier on Thursday, who are 21 and 40 years old, returned to Israel. Hamas said it handed them over to the Red Cross in Gaza City, suggesting they may have been held in northern Gaza, where Israeli troops have confronted much of the area for weeks and have been searching for hostages. And again, I believe that after this reading, the ceasefire could have already started up again. Here's an article from the Nation and World section. It's called "A Court Renews Gag Order. Ex-President Regularly Disparaged a Law Clerk. Others Involved in Case." Jennifer Peltz and Michael R. Sizak, Associated Press. A New York appeals court reinstated a gag order Thursday that barred Donald Trump from commenting about court personnel after the former president repeatedly disparaged a law clerk in his New York civil fraud trial. The one-sentence decision came 2 weeks after an appellate judge put the gag order on hold while the appeals process played out. Trial Judge Arthur Engoron, who imposed the restriction, said he plans to enforce it vigorously and rigorously. Engoron imposed the gag order October 3 after Trump posted a derogatory comment about the judge's law clerk to social media. The post, which included a baseless allegation about the clerk's personal life, came on the second day of the trial over New York Attorney General Letitia James' lawsuit. James' lawsuit alleges Trump exaggerated his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. Trump denies wrongdoing. The Republican 2024 frontrunner contends the lawsuit is a political attack instigated by James and furthered by Engoron, both Democrats. Over the trial's first few weeks, Engoron fined Trump $15,000 for violating the gag order. The judge expanded the order, which initially covered only parties in the case, to include lawyers after Trump's attorneys questioned Clerk Allison Greenfield's prominent role on the bench. She sits beside the judge, exchanging notes and advising him during testimony. Trump lawyers sued for Engoron, challenging his gag order as an abuse of power. State lawyers supported the restriction, saying it was a reasonable step to protect Engoron's staff. An attorney for the court system tied Trump's comments to an uptick in nasty calls and messages directed at the judge and law clerk. A court security captain wrote in a sworn statement last week that Greenfield has been receiving 20 to 30 calls per day to her personal telephone and 30 to 50 messages per day on social media, LinkedIn, and two personal email addresses. The captain reported that Greenfield received enough harassing voicemails to fill a transcript with 275 single-spaced pages, and about half the harassing and disparaging messages to her were anti-Semitic. Trump's lawyers argued he shouldn't be muzzled because of other people's bad behavior, and Trump never called for violence against Greenfield, nor did he or his lawyers encourage or condone harassment and threats, the attorney wrote in a court filing. Attitudes against fossil fuels build. Attendees okay funds to help poor nations hit by climate change. It's written by Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press. Dateline is Dubai. United Arab Emirates' pressure to phase out fossil fuels mounted Thursday on the oil company chief, who took over fragile international climate negotiations that opened in Dubai amid concerns about what some say are contradictory dual roles. United Nations and climate talks leaders might have relieved some of the pressure with an early victory they called unprecedented. Negotiators unanimously approved contentious plans to launch and fund a new program to compensate poor nations hit by floods, storms, drought, and other climate extremes. Several nations, led by host United Arab Emirates, immediately pledged more than $420 million for the new fund, which took 30 years to approve. Leaders said they hoped the quick win on a key financial issue would set a new tone for negotiations that put the climate talks' newly installed boss on the hot seat. Days before the start of the United Nations Conference of Parties, called COP28, COP28, reports published meeting preparation notes that linked efforts by the United Arab Emirates, national oil company ADNOC, to push fossil fuel sales at the same time its CEO and new COP president, Sultan Al Jaber, was meeting to fight climate change. The burning of coal, oil, and gas are chief causes of global warming. Al Jaber vehemently denied the revelations from the BBC on Wednesday. More than 100,000 people were registered for the negotiations, more than double the previous high for these new UN talks. I think the pressure on the COP president to deliver is pretty clear and has been clear for months, German climate envoy Jennifer Morgan told the Associated Press. That's the focus here, to deliver on really a course correction. Meanwhile, the UN Weather Agency said Thursday that 2023 is all but certain to be the hottest year on record, and warned of worrying trends that suggest increasing floods, wildfires, glacier melt, and heat waves in the future. The World Meteorological Organization also warned that the average temperature for the year is up some 1.4 degrees Celsius, 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit, from pre-industrial times. Just 1/10 of a degree under a target limit for the end of the century as laid out by the Paris Climate Accord in 2015. OPEC extends oil cuts into 2024. Brazil is to join. Cartel move is meant to boost lagging crude prices across the globe. This is another Associated Press article. The dateline is London. The OPEC oil cartel, led by Saudi Arabia and allied producers, including Russia, made another big swipe at propping up lagging crude prices Thursday, expanding some output cuts into next year and bringing up and coming oil supplier Brazil into the fold. The OPEC plus oil ministers came out of an online meeting with more than 2 million barrels per day in voluntary cuts through the first 3 months of next year and declared that Brazil would join the bloc in January. Sweeping cutbacks from OPEC plus and individual member countries since October of 2022 have not made lasting changes to oil prices because of concerns about too much crude circulating in a weakening global economy. The market even shrugged off the new move, though it amounts to roughly 2% of global supply. Saudi Arabia led the deepening voluntary cuts Thursday, extending its reduction of 1 million barrels per day through March. It was followed by Russia, which is cutting 500,000 barrels per day of crude and refined oil products, and then Iraq, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Kazakhstan, Algeria, and Oman with smaller amounts. And moving to another story, Santos warns expulsion would set a precedent. Republican lawmaker accused of lying, theft, vote expected today. This is Associated Press, Washington. Defiant Representative George Santos, Republican, refuses to resign and warned Thursday that his expulsion from Congress before being convicted in a court of law would establish a precedent that is going to be the undoing of a lot of members of this body. Republicans and Democrats offered resolutions to remove the first-term Republican congressman from New York, and the House is expected to vote on one of them Friday. A critical Health Ethics Committee report released November 16 convinced more members that his actions merit the House's most severe punishment. The House Ethics Committee said it amassed overwhelming evidence of lawbreaking by Santos that was sent to the Justice Department. The report concluded flatly that he cannot be trusted after a months-long investigation into his conduct. The panel said Santos knowingly caused his campaign committee to file false or incomplete reports with the Federal Election Commission, used campaign funds for personal purposes, and violated the Ethics in Government Act concerning financial disclosure statements filed with the House. Here's a couple more shorter stories. This is Russia. Russian missile strike three Donetsk cities. Kyiv, Ukraine is the deadline. Russian missiles tore through apartment buildings in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region, local officials said Thursday, killing at least two people and burying families under rubble as the Kremlin's forces continued to pound the fiercely contested area with long-range weapons. Russian military units simultaneously launched six S-300 missiles toward the Donetsk region during the night, according to Ukrainian Internal Affairs Minister Ihor Klemenko. Another two were fired separately in the same area, the Ukrainian Air Force said. Klemenko said the strikes that hit three Donetsk cities, Pokrovsk, Novohrodivka, and Mirnohorod. Emergency workers pulled the body of a 62-year-old man from a destroyed multi-store building in Novohrodivka. Sorry about that. Novohrodivka. Ukraine's emergency service reported another death in the same city. Four more people may be under rubble, authorities said. And briefly, TikTok, Montana's first in-the-nation law banning the video-sharing app TikTok in the state, was blocked Thursday, a month before it was to take effect, by a federal judge who called the measure unconstitutional. And regarding LGBTQ+, Russia's Supreme Court effectively outlawed LGBTQ+ activism Thursday, the most drastic step against advocates of gay, lesbian, and transgender rights in the increasingly authoritarian country. Salmonella. U.S. consumers shouldn't eat pre-cut cantaloupe if they don't know the source, health officials said Thursday, amid a salmonella outbreak. At least 117 people in 34 states were sickened by the contaminated fruit. 61 people were hospitalized and two died, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said. And here's a book ban. The nation's largest publisher and several best-selling authors are part of a lawsuit filed Thursday challenging Iowa's new law that bans public school libraries and classrooms from having practically any book that depicts sexual activity. It's the second suit in the past week to challenge the law. And Vatican. Pope Francis said Thursday he is suffering from acute infectious bronchitis, and doctors recommended that he cancel his planned visit to Dubai this weekend. And regarding mortgage rates, the average 30-year U.S. mortgage rate fell for a fifth week in a row to 7.22% from 7.29% last week, mortgage buyer Freddie Mac said Thursday. It's now at the lowest level in 10 weeks, though a year ago it averaged 6.49%. EPA proposes strict new water pipe rules. The most U.S. cities would have to replace lead water pipes within 10 years under strict new rules, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed Thursday, as the Biden administration tries to reduce lead in drinking water and prevent public health crises like those in Flint, Michigan, and Washington, D.C. The agency said tighter standards would improve IQ scores in children and reduce high blood pressure and heart disease in adults. It is the strongest overhaul of lead rules in more than three decades and will cost billions of dollars. The Biden administration previously said it wants all of the nation's roughly 9 million lead pipes removed. Lead crisis hit poor, majority black cities like Flint especially hard. The Biden administration says investment is vital to fix this injustice and ensure everyone has safe drinking water. Here's another story from the Associated Press. The heading is Giving Tuesday draws $3.1 billion this year, written by Thea Beatty of the Associated Press. The dateline is New York. Nonprofit organization Giving Tuesday estimates that donors gave $3.1 billion this year on what has become one of the most important fundraising days of the year, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. Donations were up $20 billion on Tuesday, That's a 0.6% increase over last year before adjusting for inflation, the nonprofit said. Giving Tuesday makes its estimate by drawing on data from donor management software companies, donation platforms, payment processors, and donor advised funds. On the one hand, this is fantastic, said Woodrow Rosenbaum, Giving Tuesday's chief data officer. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. came together once again to have a huge impact for causes they care about, including donating an enormous amount of money in a 24-hour period. But the number of donors was down about 10% from 2022, which Rosenbaum called a worst-case scenario for the sector. We're seeing less dollars from the big donor that we've been relying upon, and fewer grassroots donors who are so important to our resilience and long-term health of the sector. Nonprofit organizations and industry groups have been warning that donations this year are down, which follows a drop in overall charitable giving in 2022 for only the fourth time in 40 years, according to Giving USA. It's still too early to know whether end-of-year giving will pull charitable donations back up this year. Elaine Koenig, chief communications officer at Vanguard Charitable, which hosts donor-advised funds, said about 30% of the total grant dollars donated from those accounts each year go out in the last 2 months of the calendar year. We absolutely lean into those traditional cycles of giving, which I feel like Giving Tuesday really capitalizes on, she said. But their account holders also responded with urgency to major events like the wildfires that devastated Maui in August, Koenig said. Giving is the nicest thing to do and the best thing to do, and you get more from it than probably what you give, said Naomi Thompson, who works for a cancer charity in Northern Ireland. Especially when donors feel like they have less to give, she suggested really considering whether the organization's work makes an impact on the donor's community. Giving Tuesday's estimates don't include gifts to mutual aid groups, donations to political organizations, or gifts made directly to individuals, Rosenbaum said. Still, the results may indicate further difficult times ahead. When we see this increase in the average donation on Giving Tuesday, Rosenbaum said, we see that as a warning sign, not as something that we shouldn't be looking for. Moving to the sports section, here's a story about Tiger Woods. The heading is Woods has sloppy finish in his return. It's an Associated Press story. Bahamas is the dateline. Tiger Woods held up just fine Thursday in his first time competing in 8 months, except for limping at the end. That was more about his golf than his fused right ankle. Woods was holding his own at the Hero World Challenge until a double bogey from a bush on the par 5 15th, followed by two more bogeys. The result was a 3-over-75, 8 shots out of the lead, and a score better than only two players in the 20-man field at Albany. Asked what he got out of his round, Woods laughed and said, hit a lot of shots. British Open champion Brian Harman and Tony Finau led the way at 5-under-67, 1 shot ahead of Jordan Spieth, who was as entertaining as ever. Spieth made only 5 pars and had one stretch of 10 holes without one until the final hole. But this day was all about Woods, as it usually is whenever he plays, and especially when he has been away for so long. He expected to be rusty, and eventually it showed. I didn't have my feels, Woods said. Conditions were tough early. I did not finish off the round like I needed to. Kind of went sideways at the end. He was 1-under for the round through 14 holes when he pulled his tee shot to the left at the base of a bush. He contemplated his option before deciding to try to punch it out toward the fairway or even a bunker, even though he could take the club back only a foot or so. Woods caught mostly soil and advanced it only a few feet, punched his third shot back to the fairway, and then came up about 40 yards short of the green. He pitched that to 10 feet only to miss the bogey putt. He found a fairway bunker off the tee on the tough 16th, came up short of the green and hit a weak pitch to 20 feet that led to a bogey. Then he three-putted the par 3, 17th from 45 feet. Woods wasn't the only player who struggled in his return. Will Zalatoris had back surgery right after he withdrew from the Masters. He had three double bogeys and a bogey in a four-hole stretch around the turn and closed with one more bogey for an 81. Still in sports, here's a power poll. It's the nine of the Big Ten's 14 teams will continue their seasons with a bowl game, including a five-win Minnesota. The postseason begins with a Michigan-Iowa Conference Championship. Michigan, 12-0, 9-0 for the Big Ten, is last week, they were number one, and won 30-24 versus Ohio State, a third straight win over Ohio State, now puts Michigan on the cusp of its third consecutive Big Ten championship as well. Head coach Jim Harbaugh will return to the sidelines this week, too, hoping to guide the Wolverines back into the college football playoff. And here's number two, Ohio State, 11-1 and 8-1 in their previous number two. They are 30-24 versus Michigan, a good but not great offense limited Ohio State at times this season, including a loss to Michigan that likely ends its playoff chances. A New Year's Six bowl is still highly likely, but head coach Ryan Day has come under scrutiny from sections of the Buckeye fan base, unhappy with another defeat to Michigan. And here's number three, Penn State, 10-2 and 7-2, 42-0 versus Michigan State. An excellent regular season for quarterback Drew Aylar concludes with the sophomore having thrown for 2,300 yards, 23 touchdowns, and just one interception, with an excellent defense also in place. Penn State will be one of the favorites to make the 12-team playoff next season. Number four, Iowa, 10-2 and 7-2. And 7-2, previous number four, win 13-10 versus Nebraska. Despite a historically bad offense, Iowa is a 10-win team and is headed to the conference title game. It's another excellent year for head coach Kirk Ferentz, whose contract runs through the 2029 season but will reportedly consider retirement in the offseason. Northwestern, 7-5 and 5-4, and a bowl game victory would also mean the program's winningest season since 2018. Number six is Maryland, 7-5 and 4-5, and it's an excellent career for quarterback Tagliola, should lead to an NFL draft selection after one final appearance in a Maryland jersey. Number seven is Wisconsin, 7-5 and 5-4, previous. 28-14 versus Minnesota. It was an up-and-down season for first-year head coach Luke Fickle, whose seven wins equaled Wisconsin's 2022 total. Improvements will be needed for next season, especially if running back Braylon Allen heads to the NFL. Number eight is Rutgers, which are 6-6 and 3-6. And six-win season means that Rutgers has still been far more successful with head coach Greg Schiano leading the way than without him. He continues to try to rebuild a Rutgers program that shows bright spots but has been unable to make a major jump in quality. And we go on to Illinois, Minnesota, Nebraska, Purdue, Michigan, and Indiana. Now, I'm not going to read all of those there. I'm going to stop with that. For the moment, anyway. And you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Here's a story from the Fort Dodge Messenger. It's on the front page. It's called Aftermath. Fire's cause may never be discovered. It's written by James Curtis. Dateline is Webster City. Wednesday's downtown Webster City fire was so hot that it cracked the face mask worn by two of the first firefighters to reach the blaze. And the scene was blinding. Visibility was zero from the moment we got in there, Webster City Fire Chief Chuck Stanfield said. Then firefighters pulled the ceiling and the blaze grew. How the fire started will likely never be known. Stansfield said the fire's intensity probably destroyed any clue to its origin. At this time, the origin of the fire appears to have been in the upstairs and attic space of the building, he said in a media release Thursday morning. Cause has not been identified and will likely go undetermined due to the severity of the damage. At this time, the fire appears to be unintentional. The afternoon inferno gutted the former Bettis appliance store at 608 2nd Street. Next door to the east, two pets were rescued from the building that houses Sandy's Attic, a retail resale shop. A parrot was rescued from the store early during the fire, Stansfield said. Firefighters were able to go back in later and get its cage. They also rescued a cat living in an upstairs apartment. It was still being cared for by the Webster City Veterinarian Clinic Thursday, Stansfield said. No one was injured. The two apartments on the second floor of the burned structure were apparently unoccupied. Reports of a fireman falling from the building are unfounded. Ladder trucks from Webster City, Eagle Grove, and Fort Dodge converged to keep the blaze from spreading to the historic Webster Theater to the west of the burning building. Billowing smoke filled the theater almost immediately as the blaze next door raged and there were worries that it would catch fire, but it didn't. Neither did the Sandy's Attic building. Both sustained smoke and water damage, Stansfield said. Jeff Pingold, president of the board of HERO, Help Entertain and Restore Organization, the group that restored the theater, said the building sustained serious water damage. He shared photos from inside the theater Thursday. Water warped its dropped ceiling tiles, and some of the new seats purchased during its renovation several years ago were covered with water-soaked material that had fallen from above. An aerial photo showed that its roof is intact. That is in contrast to the 5,360-square-foot gutted building next door. Built in 1900 with 12-inch brick walls, according to historic Sanborn fire maps. It is now owned by Jason and Chelsea Watts, according to Hamilton County property records. The fire was first reported by Nick Whitmore at 12:41 p.m. Wednesday. He told Webster City Police dispatchers that he saw smoke coming from the second floor of the building next to Sandy's Attic, according to police call logs. Webster City Fire was attacking the blaze in minutes. Upon arrival, L31 found a heavy brown smoke pumping out from the upper windows of the structure, Stansfield said, referring to the radio call sign for the department's ladder truck. Firefighters entered the building, burning building. As interior crews noted worsening conditions, they were ordered to back out. Shortly after this, the roof of the building partially collapsed. At this point, the fire attack went defensive and all personnel were ordered to stay out of the building. It was at this point that Webster City Fire called for mutual and from Stanford, Tacoma, Eagle Grove, and Fort Dodge. Ladder trucks from Eagle Grove and Fort Dodge meant three departments were simultaneously able to attack the fire from above. At the same time, multiple ground hoses were employed. The Webster City Police Department, Hamilton County Sheriff's Department, Hamilton County Emergency Manager, Webster City Street Department, and Van Deest Medical Center, EMTs, all provided support, he said. And the good people of Webster City all assisted in keeping this fire under control, Stansfield said. Special thanks to all the people and surrounding businesses that provided water to our personnel, food later in the call, and support throughout. This was a team effort and all involved deserve huge thanks. Being able to contain the fire as it was would not have happened without all the help. It was a team effort with everybody, Stansfield said. Fire was officially out at 4:10 p.m. Here are a couple in brief notes. The Stratford Lutheran Church to hold the Lucia Festivity at Light of Light, December 9. Stratford, the Lucia Festivity of Light is 2 p.m. December 9 at the Stratford Lutheran Church, Stratford. There will be light refreshments following the program. A free will donation will be accepted. The church is looking for community members of all heritages, ages, and talents to participate in this annual tradition. Those wishing to participate should sign up before Sunday by contacting Joni Stark Miller at 515-351-7220. Program participants should be available on December 9 from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Young ladies ages 14 to 19 are invited to be Lucia candidates. Girls and boys ages 5 to 13 are invited to participate as Lucia maidens. Star Boys and Tom Tin to present represent the Greater Swede Bend communities, which include Southern Webster, Western Hamilton, and Northeast Boone counties. And symphony concerts set for Sunday, the Fort Dodge Area Symphony will hold its annual holiday concert at 3 p.m. Sunday in the Fort Dodge Middle School, which is at 800 North 32nd Street, in collaboration with the Fort Dodge Area Fine Arts Association members. The symphony will be joined by local actors to present Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, in a concert event for the whole family. Single tickets can be purchased at the door on Sunday, and adult tickets are $15. Students are admitted free. And here's a rundown of some other events going on in the area. Webster City Women's Club Festival of Trees is 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. today, and 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday at the Jane Young House at 629 Elm Street. And there will be 18 decorated Christmas trees with Christmas songs and themes. Infanda Arts Center presents Songs of Christmas at 2 p.m. Sunday at the center. Admission and refreshments are free. Gowrie United Methodist Women's Coffee and Bazaar is 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday at Gowrie United Methodist Church. There will be coffee, baked items, candy, cookie walk, rye bread, and craft items. Humboldt Gowanus Christmas Land is 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. today and Saturday, and 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday at 4407 First Avenue Street in Humboldt. Admission is free. Donations will be accepted. Emmitsburg Gowanus Pancake and Omelette Breakfast in support of the Emmitsburg Dance Team is 8 a.m. to noon Sunday at the VFW in Emmitsburg. And again in Emmitsburg, Glenn Henriksen concert is 2 p.m. Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church, Emmitsburg. A free will offering will be accepted. Goodies will follow the concert. And calendar. Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Calendar is holding its annual Christmas fair and luncheon from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Saturday. And let's go to Fort Dodge. Fort Frenzy, 3232 First Avenue South, is holding a free meet and greet with Santa, Mrs. Claus, and the Grinch from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday. There will be photos, cookies, and hot chocolate. And in Fort Dodge, Area Symphony will hold its annual holiday concert 3 p.m. Sunday, Fort Dodge Middle School Auditorium. Symphony will be joined by local actors to present Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol in a concert event for the whole family. Single tickets may be purchased at the door on the day of the concert. Adult admission is $15, and students are admitted free. And a time for angels service of remembrance is 1:30 p.m. Sunday, St. Olaf Lutheran Church, 239 North 11th Street in Fort Dodge. Here are a couple, three obituaries for today. Robert Strain, 87, of Colville, passed away Tuesday the 22nd. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, December 7th at 1 p.m., Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery with military rites conducted by the VFW Post 1856 and the U.S. Army Honor Guard. Visitation will be held on Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m., Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Patricia Coster, Lake City. Funeral Mass will be 4 p.m. Friday at the St. Mary Catholic Church in Lake City. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Lamp and Powers Funeral Home. Here's Robert Strain, age 87. Funeral December 7th at 1 p.m., Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Visitation will be Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Darlene Rhodes, age 87. Funeral will be Saturday, December 9th at 11 a.m. Grace Lutheran Church. Visitation Friday, December 8th, 4 to 7 p.m. Lofsweiler Funeral Home. And Shirley Waddell, age 93. Services will be at a later date. Cornell Williams, age 52, will be private family services. Kevin Miller, age 59, will have private family services. Turning over to the sports section here, Dodger wrestlers hit the mat. Fort Dodge will compete at ultra-competitive Donnybrook. Written by Chris Johnson. The dateline is Coralville. There will be no time for the Fort Dodge wrestling team to get their feet wet as they dive straight into tough competition. The Dodgers will compete this weekend at the Dan Gable Donnybrook. Fort Dodge will begin competition at 11:30 a.m. and continue through the quarterfinals. Action will begin at 10 a.m. on Saturday with the championship and third and fifth place medals starting at 7 p.m. "We are ready to get some competition," said Fort Dodge head coach Bobby Thompson. "It was tough. It was tough not having an open duel because it didn't set us up well for tournament. For the tournament, the Dodgers have 9 state qualifiers returning with 5 medalists back on the mat. Sophomore Dreshawn Ross, 215, is back after winning a state title at the biggest weight as a freshman in Iowa history. Dreshman's older brother, senior Damarian Ross, 175, was a state runner-up, as was senior Drew Alaya, 120, who finished second for the second consecutive year. Junior Coy Davidson, 138, was fourth, a year after earning a silver medal. Senior Cal Hartman, 190, placed seventh. Earning state bids a year ago for the Dodgers were sophomore Sam Davidson of 113, senior Kane Buttrick at 132, and sophomore Riley Brown, 144, sophomore Jesse Egli at 165. The Dodgers will have 3 freshmen in their lineup with Trace Ryall, 106, Bo Marsh, 126, and Jay Scow at 157. Rounding out the Dodger lineup will be junior Hunter Richardson, 150, sophomore Luke Frake, 285. Dodgers are still looking for their first champion. At the Donnybrook, Aya and Coy Davidson were both third a year ago, while Dreshawn Ross placed fourth. "Last year we came down and didn't perform as well as we would have liked, but the next weekend in Council Bluffs we did," Thompson said. "The field down here is pretty tough. 39 teams from the Midwest will compete in the tournament. This will be the toughest tournament we will compete in," Thompson said. "There will be solid teams from Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Missouri, along with some of the toughest kids in the state. Every weight class will be tough with a 40-man bracket. Hopefully we can use this as a measuring stick." Here's an article written by Chris Johnson. "Strong first round for Dodgers" is the headline. "Fort Dodge's Benedict pulls us loose in quarterfinal round." Excuse me, dateline is Coralville. The Fort Dodge girls wrestling team started out hot in the first round of the Dan Gable Donnybrook on Thursday. The Dodgers won 6 of their 9 matches to stay alive on the winner's side. "We did what we wanted to do in the first round," said Fort Dodge head coach John Koning. "After that, we struggled a little. This tournament is long, but the level of competition and the setup is what we want." Benedict, 135, and Maddie Poulos, 170, advanced to the quarterfinal round before being sent to the backside. And Maddie wrestled well. They just got caught in tough positions in the quarters. Koning said, "This tournament is exactly what we want because we see out-of-town girls that we normally wouldn't face." Benedict, 17-2, won her first 2 matches by fall, 8 seconds and 3 minutes and 28 seconds. She lost in the quarterfinals to Alexis Spearson of Omaha, 8-2. Poulos, 13-5, won her first match by fall, 1 minute and 11 seconds, as well as her second, 2 minutes and 52 seconds. She lost to Esperanza Calvillo of Apple Valley, 5.21 seconds. Delaney O'Connor, 140, lost her match but bounced back with 2 falls. Lucy Porter, 145, Macy Brown, 130, and Araya Fellers, 115, all had 2 victories on the day. Alendra Manzanilla, 105, and Grace Harvey, 110, had 1 win each. Algona's Reagan Haynes, 16-2, is in the 170-pound semifinal. Haynes earned 3 falls, 2 in the second period, and a 30-second pin over Bettendorf's Reese Schrader, 12-3. The Dodgers, who picked up 11 wins by fall, are back in action at 10 p.m. Finals, third and fifth place matches begin at 7 p.m. Jorgensen wins twice. The dateline is Des Moines. The Fort Dodge swim team returned to the pool here Thursday night against Des Moines Lincoln. The Rails claimed the duel by a final score of 114-52. Carter Jorgensen swept the freestyle events, winning the 200 and 500. He claimed the 200 title in 2.08.21 and the 500 in a time of 5.49.03. Aiden Segrin was a runner-up in the 200 free to Jorgensen, with Matt Besch taking second in the 100 butterfly and Evan Cooper second in the 50 free. The Dodger 200 medley relay of Brady Major, Colin Roberts, Besch, and Cooper placed second, as did the 200 freestyle relay of Cale Keith, Jorgensen, Besch, and Cooper. Kaysen Echeverra, Evan Potter, Jaden Stanley, and Kobe Bacon won the junior varsity 400 free relay, and the quartet of Bacon, Elijah Lawrence, Aiden Hernandez, and Echeverra were first in the 200 free relay. Fort Dodge returns to action this Saturday at the Boone Invitational. The ISU women bounce back. This deadline is St. Paul. Article in the sports section. Minnesota, Iowa State got back in the win column with an 85-44 victory over St. Thomas 3-4 Summit on Wednesday night. With a three-pointer in the first quarter, Iowa State reached 900 consecutive games with a made triple, the longest streak in all of NCAA women's basketball. The streak began on February 19, 1995, at Colorado when Tara Gunnarsson hit a triple. Kelsey Jones led the Cyclone 3-3, 3-3, and 0-0 Big 12 effort, with the first three-pointer made and 17 total points on 6 of 8 shooting from the floor to go along with 5 rebounds, 2 assists, and 1 block. Neymar Drew, 12, Audie Crooks, 12, and Jalen Bristow, 10, also joined in double-figure scoring. Addie Brown had a near-double-double with 9 points and 8 rebounds, following a St. Thomas layup. Kelsey Jones knocked down a three-pointer that allowed the Cyclones the historical milestone game. Audie Crooks and Naomer Dew followed up with layups to push the Cyclone lead to 5 with 5.56 remaining in the quarter. Addie Brown got on the board with a layup, and Jones added 4 points midway through. Here's an area sports roundup. Tritons moved to 7-0. Cedar Rapids is the dateline. Lainey Pilcher led a balanced effort for the Iowa Central women here Tuesday night as the Tritons downed Mount Mercy JV 72-42. Pilcher scored 11 points. Mia Danielson added 10. And both Caitlin Tindall and Olivia Miller, 9 for the Tritons, 7-0 overall. Lainey Mayo added 8 points, 3 rebounds, and 2 block shots. Iowa Central opens ICCAC play on Saturday in Iowa Falls versus Ellsworth at 1 p.m. And Iowa Central falls on the road. This dateline is Marshalltown. Iowa Central men fell to Marshalltown here Wednesday night, 76-56. The Tritons were led by Miles Fance, 17 points and 7 rebounds, while Deuce Blake added 9. Iowa Central opens ICCAC action on Saturday at Ellsworth in Iowa Falls. The tip is set for 3 p.m. And St. Elmo sweeps at Webster City. The St. Elmo 7th grade girls earned 2 wins over Webster City here Thursday night. In the A game, the Gales won 22-12 as Alesson Whitmore scored 10. They are now 3-2 on the year. St. Edmund claimed the B contest 14-12 on a Casey McGongle game-winning ducket, but they are now 3-1 on the season. And Webster City Gale 8th graders fall. The St. Elmond 8th grade girls dropped a 32-8 decision to Webster City Thursday night. Olivia Andrew and Tornan Hale, H-E-L-L-E, each scored 4 points for the Gales. In the B game, the Lynx won 8-6 as Jennifer Torney had 3. Here's a rundown of the things that are coming up for the men. Friday, December 1, which is today, Iowa State is at DePaul, 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December 2, Northern Iowa is at Evansville, 1 p.m., and Drake versus Missouri State at 1 p.m. on Saturday. Monday, December 4, Iowa is at Purdue at 6 p.m. Wednesday, December 6, Northern Iowa versus Richmond at 7 p.m. Drake versus St. Louis, 7 p.m. on Wednesday. And we go to Saturday, December 9, Northern Iowa is at Toledo, 1 p.m. game. Drake versus Nevada, is at 6:30 p.m. And Sunday, December 10, Iowa State versus Prairie View A&M at noon. Iowa versus Michigan, 3:30. Tuesday, December 12, you'll see Northern Iowa versus Prairie View A&M at 7 p.m. Thursday, December 14, Drake versus Grambling, 7 p.m. Saturday, December 16th, Iowa versus Florida A&M. Sunday, December 17th, Northern Iowa versus Alcorn State, 7 p.m., and Iowa State versus Florida A&M at 5 p.m. That's kind of a long ways down the road, but a nice idea of what's coming up for now. And the women, Saturday, December 2nd, Iowa versus Bowling Green at 12:30, Drake at Minnesota at 1. And Sunday, December 3, you have Iowa State versus UNC Wilmington, 1 p.m., Northern Iowa at Creighton. And Wednesday, December 6, Iowa's at Iowa State at 6 p.m. There's a few of the things that are going on in the upcoming weeks and months. Kicked a few words there. I'm sorry, folks. I didn't get them as clear as I like. Sorry. And before we close things off here, here's the front page of the sports section. There's a big Williams College, women's college basketball fan favorite in big, bold, black letters. And underneath, it's a color picture of Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who signs autographs after an NCAA game against Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Young girl getting Caitlin's autograph on her Iowa shirt. And both seem excited. So fans young and old come to watch Clark. This is part of this. I'm going to read short parts of it by Tim Reynolds. Astora, Florida. They start showing up an hour or more before games. They've got their faces painted. They're carrying signs. They're wearing number 22 jerseys. Some are old. Some are young. Men, women, boys, girls. They're all there. Officially, they come to watch number 4, Iowa. More specifically, they come to watch Caitlin Clark. It is perhaps the best circus in women's basketball. All eyes are on Clark, the reigning Associated Press National Player of the Year and someone on pace to win the national scoring title for a record third time. From the moment she steps onto the floor for warm-ups to the time she waves goodbye when the game ends. Her game has brought fame, nearly 800,000 followers on Instagram, Fortune, Nike, and State Farm are among her many endorsement deals, and she's on pace to become the leading scorer in Division I women's history later this season. Caitlin said, "The way people have on our jerseys, the way people have on Iowa clothes, it's just not the same for every other program," Clark said. "So I think for me, it's just don't let it overwhelm you. Don't let the moment pass you by. Living in the now is super important. It's really special. These are going to be some of the best moments of my life that I get to share with my best friends as a kid who's 21 years old in college. I play this game because I love it. I play because it's fun. And when I play that way, that's what allows me to be as good as I am." She ends by saying, "Just enjoy every single moment. Soak it in and know no moment is ever too big," Clark said. "I think our team really steps up when the lights kind of shine the brightest." Well, folks, that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and Mason City Globe-Gazette for Friday, December 1st. And my name is, your reader today has been me, Doug Kretzinger. I appreciate you listening. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I wish you all a good day.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.